Thank you. Be seated. The court is pleased to welcome a delegation from the Supreme Court of Kazakhstan and members of Bracewell and Patterson and the chairman of the regional court system, and we will be meeting with these fine individuals later on today. The court is ready to hear argument now in 031050, Alex Sheshchenov Management Services versus Kenneth Johnson and Strunk and Associates.
May it please the court, Mr. Mike Capetta will present arguments. The petitioner deserves 6 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Mr. Chief Justice, thank you for your excellent pronunciation of Mr. Sheshchenov's name.
We know that you're John McKinnon.
Irish grandmother has made me a Mike ever since, but I'm both John McKenna, Justice Owen, and Mike McKenna. This case comes here on summary judgment and tests the enforceability of a non-compete agreement and brings several very important things for which we are grateful that the court has accepted review and will give guidance. One is the importance of predictability. 10 years ago, this court gave an excellent exposition about a statute and gave the guidance both of the statute and of what some courts and commentators have called a blueprint, setting out what does and what does not comport with a sufficient agreement in order to have an enforceable non-compete. Predictability is extremely important. Lawyers drafting, parties negotiating, and parties seeking to hire and parties seeking to enforce should not have to guess from judge to judge what will happen.
Let me just ask you a question. Let's say you're at a company and you have access to a certain body of confidential information. The company decides, whoops, we really better get this protected. Then comes to the employee and says, now we want you to sign it because we've given you this in the past. You now need to sign it. Now, presume with me that the confidential information doesn't change. I understand in this case you claim it does because client lists and databases that are constantly changing, so every day it's newly confidential. But presume that it wasn't newly confidential. Presume it was a formula for something. And you've had access to it for 20 years with no agreement. The company says, now we want you to sign it because this is confidential in consideration of us having given this to you in the past. We want you to sign this agreement, and you sign it. What then?
There's a decision out of Beaumont that addresses exactly that situation, Your Honor. It's referred to as the Wright case, and it has two pieces. The piece that has been discussed in the briefing is the piece where it says, like the Supreme Court in the Light case and like every court of appeals except Austin, it says a promise to give confidential information is sufficient. But the other piece answers your question.
There's no new consideration there.
The other piece, it says, we now have to reach the question of reasonableness of the restraint for the circumstances presented. And this record is not clear enough for us to know the quality of the protectable information and whether it is different information.
But again,
you put that in the remedy of would it be right to protect things that were not different.
But presume it's a formula that you've had access to forever. It hadn't changed. They come to you and say, now we want you to sign the agreement. You sign the agreement. There's no new consideration there. But do you need new consideration?
I would actually say there is new consideration, Justice O'Neill. I would say that unless some record showed that it was memorized information, that there is a benefit to having a contractual right to reaccess that information, get that new training in the facts of this case, get the new information in the facts of this case, but in your hypothetical, to reaccess the Coca-Cola formula, to reaccess the information that will somehow help me in my job and after my post-employment constraints may have benefits to me in my general learning, though I still have to keep confidences. there is a contractual right to see information which my employer is saying I won't give you access to anymore if you don't sign this. I would say that now having a contractual promise is better than having an employer who has never promised me that I'll get any continuing access to that. So I would call it new consideration. But to answer the second part of your question, does it matter if it's new and different consideration? It is an enforceable contract. It's an enforceable promise. And for the purpose of the statute and for the purpose of the analysis under Light, I think the testing is whether there is now two enforceable contracts. And every case, including Light through its guidance and cases holding it, except the Austin cases, has said if there is a promise by the employer to furnish confidential information and or training, and if there is a promise by the employee to keep confidential or otherwise give the ancillary, the agreement that supports the non-compete, if there are promise by each, that will support the non-compete. And that's the analysis, whether or not we would test is that new consideration or not. But Ms. Justice O'Neill, I would say it's new consideration if I now have a power to insist on something that yesterday I didn't have the power to insist on. That's consideration.
Footnote 14 in Light says that thus, if an employer gives an employee confidential and proprietary information, then consequences follow. Doesn't that suggest that more than a promise is necessary, that the training and confidential information have to be actually provided?
Justice Wainwright, you've spotted exactly what misled the Austin Court of Appeals. If you look at footnote 15, and if you look at the promise in Light to give training, the Supreme Court squarely held, and I think the page number of the holding is on page
646.
Well, I'm going back just a few pages from footnote 14 and footnote 15. It squarely held that the promise to give training, it wasn't received yet, it wasn't given, it was a promise to receive, said it is a non-illusory promise. And footnote 15, I'm again going to the next footnote after the one you ask about, says that if there had been here the employee promise in return, these circumstances would have enforced the non-compete. And therefore, when the Austin court focused on the word gives, it gave a meaning to it that I think this court and Justice Cornyn did not intend. I think that footnote 14 gave that as an instance, but did not say it must be only by giving, because the clear language that the promise to give training, a promise that I will do something, is enough and is not illusory. And footnote 15's emphasis that that was so.
Well, I hear what you're saying, and you're, I think, looking for a way to reconcile the statements and footnote 14, 15, and the holding that you mentioned. I don't hear you suggesting we should ignore footnote 14. Oh, you're trying to reconcile them. Let's think about that conceptually. In a contract that's not a non-compete, and I understand the statute's a bit different, and it was the result of some back and forth between the legislature and the court on non-compete. But in a contract, generally, if I make a promise to do something and you make a return promise, that I never perform my promise. Do we have an enforceable contract?
Oh, you bet you do, and that's the importance of the DeSantis against Black and Hutt decision that we were so disappointed we couldn't get the Austin court to focus on.
And you have a breach of contract action.
That's right, and what is enforcement other than to have a remedy when somebody fails to perform their promise? And Black and Hutt case, and the cases, the Langman and so on, the cases that are never mentioned by the Austin court, though we had urged them to look at that, I think they're proving the point that Your Honor raises. How can somebody say that a promise is illusory when it gives valuable, substantial, and powerful rights so that if the employer did not perform, if in Light, if Centel did not give that training, which was a non-illusory promise, if in this Sheshonoff case, if Sheshonoff did not give access to the 6 specifically named databases and the training, which the record makes clear it did give access to, if it didn't, what a powerful remedy Mr. Johnson would then have, because it was enforceable contract with legal consequences, and he would be excused from all the post-termination powers. That's the Wackenhut case that Mr. Justice Heck
I make the promise to provide trade secrets.
Yes.
And 5 minutes later, I fire him.
And don't give the trade secrets, and the promise was unconditional. It wasn't, Your Honor, it would be illusory if I said, I'll give you trade secrets if you keep the job, rather than I promise, you come to me as an employee, I will give you trade secrets. If it's unconditional, and then 5 minutes later, you fire me.
Which I have the right to do in Texas.
Not under our contract, but under the Light contract, under the at-will contract in Light. Then the employee would say, where are those trade secrets you promised me and for which I gave a non-compete? You never gave them. That's what the Light case was saying. If the reason that the promise to give training was enforceable is because there were consequences if the employer failed to meet its promise. It was not illusory. It was not something that the employer could say, if I feel like it, I'll give you training. If you keep your job for longer than a second, I'll give you training. It was an unconditional promise, which if it was not given, the employee has complete power to say, because of the enforceability of contracts, I am excused from my obligations post-termination because a promise made to me was breached. That's very important, and Mr. Justice Wainwright, I think that's the importance of footnote 14, footnote 15, and the discussion of the promise to train.
Let me ask you this. People only do non-competes when they don't want employees to steal clients and business when they leave. What business with clients and accounts wouldn't give training and wouldn't have some trade secrets in the sense of customers and what they bought for before?
I think many do, many don't. There are many instances of businesses where the ongoing things are not secret and are not
held to be secret. There's plenty of businesses that do non-competes that don't give any training or any access to trade secrets.
Well,
like what?
We see them all the time in the trucking company, where a trucking company tells its $20,000 a year trucker, here I'm going to show you how to run your rig, and then if you go somewhere else, you can't work for a year or 5 years. And courts say, no, there is nothing confidential. There was no training. There was nothing that was actually given that supports. But as in the Wright case, Your Honor, the testing is the constraint on competition reasonable for these circumstances, and where there was nothing to be protected, then the benefits in favor of the constraint are vastly outweighed by the constraint.
It's not a promise of training, it's a promise of secret training.
Your Honor, I know what the Light case says, I know what the statute says, and yet you're asking helpful and proper questions. That the question in my reading of the Light case in the statute is it's the training. It does not have to be secret. But there then has to be some reciprocal promise by the employee corresponding to that training. Typically, it would be confidentiality. It could be goodwill or relationships, but typically it would be confidentiality. If there was no training given, if there's a promise, I'm going to give you confidential information, all I gave you is the phone book, then that's a breach of a promise, or it was a false statement of some promise. But as in the Wright case, I think that's dealt with very appropriately in narrowing the constraint, and here the remarkably narrow constraint was that Mr. Johnson couldn't solicit 821 banks, but could continue against 19,000 banks, hardly any constraint at all. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Dan Berman and Mr. John Nagel will present argument for respondents. Mr. Berman will open the first 10 minutes.
Good morning.
It's remarkable in this case that Mr. McKitta and I agree on a lot of legal principles. I think the crux of our disagreement has to do with how they're applied here. Light is this court's most recent pronouncement in this area and construes the legislature's effort to preempt the law in this area. Light remains good law. There's been no intervening legislation, and there's no reason to disturb, in our view, the sound legal analysis outlined by Justice Cornyn and his application of what are basically Hornbook principles.
Well, the world's changed since then, right? When Light was written, there was no internet. Now, if I want to buy shoes, used shoes from somebody in Massachusetts, I can do it on eBay like that.
There's a Law Review article that I've read recently on this issue that suggests that the second prong of Light and the reasonableness of the scope of how one should enforce or what kind of enforcement authorities is warranted may be affected by the internet. But I think this case...
And, of course, the first prong arose from a fight between this court and the legislature where they thought these things were good and this court thought they were bad.
The first prong...
Went back and forth two or three times on that.
You're exactly right. And I think it started in 1987.
And this court is in the position of, when we established Light in the cases before it, of saying, people who promised, I won't go to work in the area for a year, can actually go to work, can break that promise, and go to work in the area for a year.
I'm not sure how this court can disregard the statutory language about requiring that the agreement be enforceable when made, and the concept of illusory promises, which is a Hornbook principle, and change the result as it applies to this case. This case, the Johnson case, the Sheshnoff case, is a contract construction case. And unless this court somehow finds that these patently illusory promises to provide Mr. Johnson with confidential information are not illusory, then I don't think you get to the next step about trying to adapt it to a changing environment. There are three different reasons why these promises supposedly made by... That's where Mr. McKitta and I depart so fundamentally. We agree on the law, but the false premise that makes this case fall apart is that there's no way that one can read this contract and find the promise to provide Mr. Johnson with confidential information to be non-illusory. The entire agreement on its face says it's terminable at will.
Well, it's not, actually, because if the company terminates him, they have to pay him for a period of time, no matter what. So isn't that a separately enforceable agreement that to which the covenant not to compete is ancillary?
The language, the way the contract is constructed is that whole section of the agreement, I think it's Section 5, says this whole agreement can be terminated at will, and then it's got a bunch of subsections below it. The subsection that you're referring to, Justice Owen, talks about a classic notice or pay in lieu of notice optional performance, just like a take or pay. And the question that the court needs to ask in determining whether that termination clause is operative here and extends and could have an impact on obligations in other parts of the contract is, what would Mr. Johnson's rights be if the company said, we're going to fire you and we're going to give you pay in lieu? What other rights would he still have under the contract? We submit, since the contract on its face says it's terminable at will, and since he agreed to accept pay in lieu of notice in that self-contained subsection, that under contract construction principles, he would have no remedies anywhere else in the contract. And then there's the separate reason why the promise is illusory, because it's too vague to be a meaningful a contract. So I think that the problem that Mr. McKitta has seized upon is, in Justice Patterson's opinion, she made a statement that a promise is not sufficient, that there must actually be an exchange of confidential information. Justice Wainwright, you hit on this. I think the way that statement has to be read for it to be reconciled with right. We agree that enforceable promises can provide a basis for consideration for non-competes.
So you think the Court of Appeals was wrong? Or sounds like they were wrong.
I think that needs to be read in context. And I think if Justice Patterson was referring to illusory promises, then it can be reconciled. And I think that's the way it has to be read. Because I do think that under contract principles, non-illusory promises to provide confidential information in the future, and this whole concept about if you don't do it at the exact instant, it doesn't hold up, I don't think that's the case. I do think that non-illusory promises to provide specialized training and confidential information get you past the first hurdle in life.
Can you have a non-illusory promise like that and still have a contract that's terminable? Well,
yes, but it won't be non-illusory if it's dependent on the ongoing at-will relationship. It has to be a separate promise that clearly, unlike here, clearly would survive the exercise of the right to terminate the at-will relationship. If that's the case...
Well, it wouldn't survive. It just would be...
It would be separate.
If it was breached, there would be consequences.
Exactly.
I mean, if you say, I promise to give you confidential information, and then the next day you say, I've changed my mind, I'm going to fire you instead. Well, he can do that. Fire him instead, but then he can't enforce the non-compete because he never got the confidential information.
But the statute directs us to look at the enforceability of the promise at the moment of formation. So all of this, I think that's where a lot of the courts of appeals have got confused. And there's 150 sites to light over the years. And a lot of times the courts of appeals talk about what might have happened or what actually did happen after the fact. The legislature has directed, and Justice Quinn has properly interpreted us, to focus, and the courts to focus on the moment of contract formation. And what happens after that is beside the point. DeSantis versus Wackenhut is a red herring. That all talks about remedies for performance. The focus in these cases needs to be on the moment of formation. Is there an enforceable, non-illusory promise to provide this? If there is, then you get to the next step.
Well, how can there? Then I'm not sure how. I'm not sure how there could ever practically be such a promise in a contract that was terminable at will. Because the next minute, you could say, I'm terminating the employment, but no employer is going to give a terminated employee confidential information after employment's terminated.
Then the legislature needs to change that. As a practical matter, for trade secrets, if you want to know the formula to Coke, you're going to either hire people for terms and say that you're here for at least 6 months, and during that we're going to give you the formula to Coke.
All right, but my question was, can you have a non-illusory promise to give confidential information or training in a contract that is otherwise, a contract of employment that is otherwise terminable at will? And you said yes, but it doesn't sound like there is. It doesn't sound like it's possible.
The best practical example of that is the illustration in light itself. I'm sending you to this highly specialized course. And whether you're fired tomorrow or not, you're still going to get to go to that course. That's a scenario where there could be an enforceable agreement that's not dependent on ongoing employment, but we're going to give you the specialized training. And because of that, we're going to impose these compete restrictions that courts need to determine whether they're reasonable given the enforceable agreement. I suspect that I've used up my 10 minutes.
You have about a minute.
I want to get there's another comment that Justice Patterson made that Mr. Maketa has seized upon in the briefing that I want to address quickly, and that is where she talks about speculating about this performance or non-performance, and that I think is addressed by the reply brief filed by Sheshnoff itself on page 18. Where the statement is made that speculation about whether ASM would have breached its promises is wholly irrelevant to whether the promises are enforceable. I think that's the key point here. What happened, what actually happened after the fact, begs the question of whether you have what is classified as an enforceable agreement. Another final point is this case is not about trade secret misappropriation. There's no suggestion here that Mr. Johnson went out and misappropriated trade secrets. And I think the court needs to remember in analyzing policy issues here that promises to keep confidential information secret are independent of and enforceable independently of agreements not to compete. Non-compete is an extra tool available in very limited circumstances to secure enforcement of those promises, and we would be in a different posture here if Mr. Johnson actually had been accused of having misused the trust conferred upon him.
May it please the court. First, let me apologize for the splitting of our time. I know that's not the smoothest way to present things, but I will tell you I don't have that much to add to the briefing that we've submitted. I'm very eager to answer any questions that the court might have about our position, but subject to those questions, I would endeavor to address in a very, hopefully a bullet point-like fashion what the dispositive points are with respect to each of the principal issues that are before the court. First, with respect to the merits of the non-compete agreement, there are several dispositive reasons that the consideration that was given to give rise to the non-compete is insufficient. It's agreed, everybody's on board with the proposition that the scope of the non-compete must be judged from the scope of the consideration given by the employer that gives rise to it. Light's very clear that that doesn't include anything that's in the future that could be accepted by way of unilateral contract or anything that is given in the past consideration.
Well, that and doesn't leave anything but the present. The employer has a real problem. He wants to keep the guy. He wants him to keep giving him access to information. He wants to take him into his confidences, but he doesn't want to use it against him. Years on down the road. And if you can't consider confidential information in the future, confidential information in the past, there's nothing left but what you hand him on the day of the contract, is there?
Not what you hand him, but what you promise him on the day of the contract. And it has to be something that's not illusory, not theoretically not illusory, but a real-world, non-illusory, a contract term that you can construe as a matter of law in the first instance and then apply to that term the statute to see whether the contract is valid, and if so, whether the restraint is reasonable under the circumstances.
And your co-counsel gave a good example of a course that you're going to let the employee attend no matter what. But you're not going to give any terminated employee confidential information just in order to enforce a non-compete agreement.
I don't disagree, and I wouldn't suggest that the court should struggle to find a way for the business community to be able to enforce these agreements simply because they want to, because this has been worked out between the court and the legislature. It's been the law for 10 years.
They won.
The legislature won, and they have not seen fit to comment further on how it was all resolved. And ultimately, you have to meet this test, failing which you default to the statute that controls that says an agreement in restraint of trade is invalid as a matter of law. Turning specifically to the consideration that's given here, Justice Owen, I would respectfully disagree that there was anything here other than at-will employment that can be terminated at will. And I direct your attention specifically to page 379.
I'm talking about consideration. I'm not saying you would characterize it differently, but there's in the sense that this reminds me somewhat of the cases we discussed in the employer context, employer-employee in the arbitration agreements. You had an existing employee at will. The employer came and said, look, we want to go to an arbitration system, and if you don't sign this arbitration agreement, I'm going to terminate you right here and now. And the employee said, okay, I'll sign it. And we held that that was sufficient consideration. And it made the arbitration, you could terminate down the line the agreement to arbitrate, but as going forward, until you did terminate the agreement to arbitrate, it was binding on both parties, even if you got fired 2 days.
And I don't think that proposition is in any way inconsistent with the legal issue to be considered in this case here.
And see, here, to me, how is this different? Because you're saying to this guy, he knew if he didn't sign the covenant not to compete, that he's going to get terminated. I mean, they weren't going to keep him on his high-level job, at least, without a covenant not to compete. And so it seems to be the quid pro quo for keeping this high-level position was his agreement that he would sign the covenant not to compete. And that came with all the bells and whistles.
I think that it is confusing to look at this in terms of simply a regular contract. The question here is, what is the consideration that's given that gives rise to an interest in not competing? Not what consideration would generally support a contract. Continued employment would support...
Continued employment in this high-level position that he would not have otherwise have been able to do had he not signed the non-compete. And plus with the termination rights, that if he were terminated the very next day, the company was obligated to pay him a number of weeks of...
When the smoke clears on this business about paying him later, what you have is a naked restraint of trade that is compensated for by cash. And you have to look not at what he was given, which is a question of fact, when a performance, black letter contract law, but the consideration that's promised. What is he entitled to as a matter of right from the moment that he signs that agreement? And the answer is absolutely nothing except cash. And it does not make enforceable a non-compete by simply going through the form blueprint of life. It must be a substantive transaction that complies with the statute. And if you look at Section 3 of the contract, which is page 379 of the record, you see clearly that, quote, either party may elect to terminate this agreement at any time for any reason. And it simply says that if the employer does that, they're going to give him some cash. And that alone is dispositive of that question in the case. The first question, is that non-compete valid? There are other issues, but that is dispositive. The second...
That's not future consideration?
It is, but it's cash. Cash does not give rise to an interest in non-competing. That's the premise that 1505 is based on.
What if at the time of offering him the non-compete, they said, we'll give you $100,000? We know you've had access to all these trade secrets for years, but now we're elevating your position, and we want to make sure we're protected. So we're going to ask you to sign this non-compete and give you a bonus, $100,000 today when you sign.
Give him $100 million. It wouldn't make any difference. Cash does not give rise to an interest in non-compete. They may really want it. They might be willing to part with that kind of money for the non-compete for a number of interesting reasons, but that will not support the non-compete. That does not comport with the statute.
What? Give us three things that would.
I promise to, if I can dovetail into that by my second point, and that is you have to look at the contract and actually construe it and see what that consideration is. In this particular case, what's interesting about it is that the undisputed facts are such that there is this amorphous sort of, you can go do some training whenever you want to at the Shashnov companies, and there's some information that's confidential. Most of that he already had. Some of that he might get in the future. The question is, you have to, and this is overlooked in a lot of the cases, either it's not addressed or it's skipped over in the reasoning, but it is beyond cavil the requirement that you actually construe the contract as a matter of law, which is why all of this is a matter of law, and then apply the statute to it. If you do that exercise, you cannot assign any meaning in a non-illusory way, any meets and bounds to this loose reference of trade secrets. You can't determine what that is. And it's not an ambiguity. No one here has contended at any point that it's ambiguous. The question is, you can't really assign any meaning to this. And it's not simply a recitation of some buzzwords that gets you into the statute. So to get back to your question. You have to actually promise something, a list of trade secrets, something that can actually be construed, that is real, that you can actually enforce after the fact, not theoretically non-illusory, but whether it's a special training course, which in light existed, there wasn't a lot of discussion about that, but apparently everybody understood exactly what course they were talking about. And the premise was that Ms. Light could actually go to that course even if she quit, even if she was fired. So
it sounds like you would say that anything that's promised that the employer could preclude from having the obligation to provide by firing the employee 5 minutes later is illusory.
I'm sorry, state that again.
Anything that the employer could promise that the employer could then not have an obligation to give by firing the employee 5 minutes later is illusory.
Yes. I know my time has expired. I have not addressed at all any of the other two points. I will not have an opportunity in rebuttal, as I understand it from the rules, to really comment on the fee issues. To the extent the court would have any questions about that, I'm very eager to answer those either here or by some supplemental briefing.
One other question. A payment of $100 million at the time he entered the contract, the contract wouldn't be illusory, because if you fire him 5 minutes later, he still has the $100 million. But it sounds like your position there is there's no nexus between that and the trade secrets.
It's not just that it has to be not illusory, but it has to give rise to the interest in non-competing. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. In addition to responding to questions, there are just a few points I want to make. First, Mr. Justice Hecht, I don't believe that the legislature instead of the court won. I think that both won and the state of Texas won. I think a policy choice was made by a legislature, that the construction of that policy choice was made by this court and made very soundly, and that the remedial portion of that statute about fashioning remedies differed enormously to the courts. So I think the state of Texas won, but the state of Texas won only if there is predictability and what is called the blueprint and is followed to the letter in this contract and in many contracts written by many law firms and used by many employers, and is then upheld by the Dallas court, by the 14th court, by the San Antonio court, by the Beaumont court, but not by the Austin court. The blueprint was this court doing a fine job, reluctantly, after the common law work that this court had done on covenant not to keep, reluctantly but well. So I just want to take issue with that observation, Your Honor. I think it's an important one. Second is that I hope we do not lose track that this is not the hypothetical that Ms. Justice O'Neill asked of an unchanging amount of information. The summary judgment record shows that there was every day constant changing of the information. And when we're told it's too vague to know what we're discussing, neither the Austin court nor either brief in the petitions or the replies or anywhere mentions what I hope the court will see. We mentioned it in our briefing. Page tab C of our brief is the contract. Page 4 is the promise. The last three lines sets out six databases which Mr. Johnson has now a contractual instantaneous opportunity and actual use of, not vague. A great deal of information promised to him with specificity. Here's the real point. The promise in light that was non-illusory to provide training does not go on in that contract to say what the training is. It's a very brief five-line paragraph quoted in the opinion. Here, the Sheshinoff-Johnson contract and many contracts throughout the state of Texas promise what was in light and promise much more and include specific data. And the reason is to avoid some claim that this is illusory or vague or whatever. It is what the Supreme Court laid out in light and more.
But you say it's not trade secret information. Is there no claim that the particular overdraft protection system is somehow trade secret?
Your Honor, I couldn't agree more that the facts that are shown here of learning and asking to know, asking for the manual of what is the bargaining strategy we'll do, how low will we go, which people should we choose, very confidential, but that all applied later at the instant of the contract. Sheshinoff was not yet trying to stake out a market against the market leader Strunk in that area. It had many other things in its database. And when we say trade secret, there are differences between confidential and trade secret. Trade secret is an important area of law, but there can be confidential information beyond trade secret.
Well, but I guess there are two categories of confidential information we're talking about here. One is the development and particulars of this overdraft protection system, and the other one is the client base.
Yes, he was in charge of 821 client relationships. He denies in the briefing, but the record is very clear that one of the principal purposes of that affiliation program that he was appointed to become in charge of was to market, to get revenue from preferred banks. And in doing that, he knew what they liked, what their weaknesses were, what their strategies were for growth, whether they wanted to sell their bank. He had all this information, and every day when anybody in that organization learned about it, they updated the database, and it was new information. And whoever had brought in the data was now always contractually available to him, and he had no contractual power to access this before. And he knew, and the summary judgment record shows, that he never would have gotten that position except they thought he had at the time signed the non-compete when it was discovered by Gabriel Sheshinoff, according to the summary judgment record, that he had failed to do so. She demanded that he sign it. He took it home over the weekend, not wanting at all to sign it, negotiated changes which the company approved. The signed document was what he included every amendment he asked for. So this was a negotiated contract so that he could keep a job and had a contractual power of access that he used, more than 50 times of training that he used. But what about at the moment of contract? I'm glad for the admission, concession, agreement by Mr. Byrne that the Austin court mistakenly chose the word gives instead of promise. A promise is enforceable. This promise was enforced, and he had, under paragraph 3, if he was terminated other than for cause is a different matter, if he was terminated other than for cause, he had the power to insist for 7 weeks minimum that he continue to have that access or to say, you failed to give it to me. Under Wackenhut, you can't enforce your post-termination agreement. Mr. Justice Heck, the layoffs happen often when people continue to have confidential information, but unfortunately, they're layoffs. It's not the consistent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Counselor. That concludes the arguments and all arguments for today, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court, action.